child never listened to me. Question authority, or you'll never hear your own voice. A silent whisper in your heart. Child, don't you repeat. Your forefather's destiny. No matter if it's written in the stars or in your imagination, you still have to go your own way. Just don't wake up within your own day. I'll teach you all of my tricks, but my hand, you will have let go. I'll give you the secret password, but what you discover inside is your own.
And that was The Secret Password by Elizabeth Dielman. And this is Gnostic Media Research and Publishing's podcast episode number 108. I'm your host, Jan Ervin. This episode is an interview with Dr. Scott Olson titled The Golden Ratio and is being released on Monday, March 21, 2011. My interview with Scott was recorded on March 19, 2011. Scott A. Olson, Ph.D., Professor of Philosophy and Religion at the College of Central Florida. Scott first received international acclaim by successfully decoding the geometric mysteries of Plato. His book, The Golden Section, Nature's Greatest Secret, received rave reviews and in 2007 was awarded a first place for design by the Bookbinders Guild of New York. A lifelong student of the ancient wisdom, he has studied under physicist David Bohm, world religion expert Houston Smith, sacred geometers Keith Critchlow and John Mitchell, and esotericist Douglas Baker. A member of the Theosophical Society in America, Scott lectures widely on the perennial philosophy in both its ancient and modern forms, with special emphasis on the divine proportion and transformative states of consciousness. In 2009, he assisted Alexei Stokov with his highly acclaimed book, The Mathematics of Harmony, From Euclid to Contemporary Mathematics and Computer Science. Today, he is working on his new book, Divine Proportion, The Mathematical Perfection of the Universe, due out in the spring of 2012. Scott will be giving a lecture and workshops in New York in May on Nature's Divine Proportion and the Canon of the Human Body. Then in June, he will travel to the Bibliotheca Alexandria, Egypt, where he will present a workshop on the philosopher-mathematicians of Alexandria, Euclid and Hypatia, for the New York Open Center's Esoteric Quest for Ancient Alexandria, Greco-Egyptian Birthplace of the Western Mind. Applying his knowledge of proportional symmetry in physique competition, Scott won first place as Mr. Minneapolis, Mr. Twin Cities, Mr. Gainesville, Mr. Northeast Florida, and the prestigious New York Open title, Mr. Apollo. A member of the Florida Bar, he resides in Ocala, Florida. His education, in 1983, he received a Ph.D. in philosophy from the University of Florida with his dissertation, The Pythagorean, Plato, and the Golden Section, A Study in Abductive Inference. And in 1982, he got a J.D. from the University of Florida. In 1997, a Master's in Philosophy from the University of London at Birkbeck College. And in 1975, he achieved a Bachelor's Cum Laude in Philosophy and Sociology from the University of Minnesota on his thesis, Platonic Aesthetics. And you can check out more of Scott's work at the New York Open Center Esoteric Quest for Ancient Knowledge Alexandria at www.esoteric.org. esotericquest.org/Egypt/. And I will be posting up on the website to this podcast the link to check out more on his upcoming Sacred Geometry workshop in New York. And I will be at the Free Your Mind Conference in Philadelphia for April 9th and 10th, giving a lecture there. Come and join us. For more information, you can check out the Free Your Mind website at www.freeyourmindconference.com. And yesterday, which was Sunday and the equinox, I finally turned the big 40. I never thought I would get this far. If only I could have possessed the knowledge I have now when I was 25. And of course, snow and more snow here on the equinox, and again today in sunny Southern California for this second day of spring. And we've had a lot of snow this year. And today, lucky me, my chains broke loose and broke my brake line on my Jeep. So after about 4 hours of arguing and persuading with AAA, I was finally able to convince them to tow the Jeep a whopping 1/3 of a mile to the repair shop down the street. And last time, this task took them, with a little white powder on the ground, about 3 days. So I was pretty happy to get it done in 4 hours. Donations. This week's show is dedicated to Sarah, Vincent, Christoph, Jeremy, Scott, and Arthur. This show is dedicated to all of you, and thank you so very much. And this show is run on donations on our website sales. This is not corporate media, but independent media in the truest sense of the words. And by donating or ordering one of the books or DVDs or the audio archives or getting a membership to download the older shows for this show, as well as a t-shirt or whatever, you help to continue this programming. And we continue to ask that you stop sending your money every month to your cable company, paying the corporate media to lie to you every day, day in and day out. And instead, invest in your and everyone else's edification by donating to shows like these. And upcoming shows. Next week, it appears it will be Jason Martineau, distant cousin to our recent guest, John Martineau of Wooden Books, here to discuss the spiritual dimensions of music. And of course, Wooden Books is the same series of books that Scott Olson, tonight's guest, is also a part of. And next week, it appears, if it's not a flip-flop between Jason, it will be Professor Bart Dean from the University of Kansas at Lawrence to discuss his recent book on the Urarina Society, which will be A Brief Change into Anthropology, and his book is very good. As well, Professor John Hupps will be back for the 2012 Meme Part 3 in early April, and he's got some explosive new material that you won't want to miss. And we've also got Miguel Connor from Aeon Byte scheduled to discuss his new book on the Gnostics, Peter Gorman to discuss his book on ayahuasca, Jose Barrera to discuss alchemy and the endocrine system, and that looks like about it for now. And again, please support this program by going to the Gnostic Media website and ordering one of the books or DVDs, She Who Remembers audio archives, or getting a membership for the old show archives, a t-shirt, etc. We greatly need your support, especially with urgent Jeep repair needs. And the views expressed by the authors and guests of this unprogram are their own and are not necessarily those held by myself, the host, or Gnostic Media. Check out the website at www.gnosticmedia.com. That's GNOSTICmedia.com. And you can contact me through the web form on the website or at contact@gnosticmedia.com. Thanks for listening, and thank you for your support. And here is my interview with Professor Scott Olson on the Golden Ratio. Enjoy. Scott, welcome to the Gnostic Media Podcast. How are you doing today?
I'm doing okay, Jan, and it's wonderful to be with you.
And I appreciate you coming on. And, of course, we had your publisher on a few weeks back, John Martineau from Wooden Books, and wanted to have you come on, and I had actually read your book recently before I had talked to him. So figured we'd follow up with you, and I think next week we're going to have Jason Martineau on as well.
Oh, tremendous. Usually does not get mentioned, but John Martineau is not only my editor, but he is the primary illustrator of my Golden Section book. And it did win a first prize for design at the New York Book Show. So I'm very proud of John.
Wow, that's a wonderful story to hear there. All right. Why don't you start off by telling us a little bit about your educational background?
Okay. Well, I started out at the University of Minnesota, and I did a double major in philosophy and sociology. And then I went on to the University of London at Birkbeck College, where I did philosophy, focusing on Plato, Aristotle, and philosophy of science, and had the opportunity to work with David Bohm during the 2 years that I was there. And I did research for the occultist, esotericist, Douglas Baker.
Why don't you tell us who David Bohm is?
Well, David Bohm is quite a famous physicist, probably maybe along with Einstein, perhaps the major physicist of the 20th century. And he would talk about things like the holographic nature of the universe and how...
He had a book, The Holographic Universe, correct?
Absolutely. And a couple of the main things for him was the implicate order that lies behind the outer explicate order. You kind of get a notion of an esoteric inner dimension that, as it turns out, to be the very mathematical things that I'm so very interested in. And then with the holographic aspect, each part contains the information of the whole, and we have a whole universe that is fractalized, fractured, interrelated proportionally from top to bottom. And as we're going to see tonight, that's in fact where the golden section comes into play. Then after Birkbeck College, I then headed to the University of Minnesota, University of Florida, and I was going to do a dissertation on precognition in space-time. After working with the Birkbeck Physics Department, which was primarily interested in psi phenomena. But I realized there aren't many philosophy teaching jobs out there, so I went to law school, got my law degree, then realized, well, somebody is going to do this golden section business if you don't do it. So I jumped back to the philosophy department and in a year cranked out my dissertation The Pythagorean, Plato, and the Golden Section, A Study in Abductive Inference. That was the title. And that was basically it for educational background.
And how did you get involved in studying sacred geometry and the Golden Section?
Well, that goes back quite a ways, back to my undergraduate work at the University of Minnesota, when I took an honors course in art and mathematics with really another famous geometer, author, Dan Peddo. And I've got switched on to, I was studying Plato already, and I began to see the patterns in nature that are prevalent everywhere and how it ties up with Plato's kind of geometry. That was the start. And as a result, I wrote a summa cum laude thesis entitled Platonic Aesthetics. And I was bitten. There was no going back.
You just mentioned Plato. Why don't we go into Plato and discuss Plato's divided line and the primordial scission.
Yeah, the ancient Egyptians called it the primordial scission, like a scissors, the first cut. And as we're going to see, the Great Pyramid, in fact, the tombs, temples, pyramids, in the end, are essentially related to that primordial scission, the first cut. And Plato, being an initiate of the Eleusinian and Egyptian mysteries, basically had to kind of keep his mouth shut. There's what was called the Sedalian Oath that was punishable by death. You could not reveal the inner initiatory secrets that were revealed. And yet Plato, even he was accused of revealing them, denied it. And yet, if you understand the process of abductive novel reasoning, as expressed by Charles Sanders Peirce, who rediscovered it in the Academy, in the writings of Aristotle and Plato, there's a way that you can abduct the solutions in Plato's dialogues. He hid them in there. And the divided line is a perfect example where he tells you, take a line and cut it unevenly. Now, the first question is, why a line and why not numbers? And the basic answer to that is because we're going to be talking about incommensurable numbers, numbers that you cannot really get your head around, so you use a line, you use geometry. And secondly, well, why would you cut it unevenly? Well, if you cut it evenly, you don't get proportion. And the key factor is there a way you can get ratio, relationship, between two things in such a way that you can actually create what's called analogous proportion, which is repeated ratio. So let me just kind of back up for a second and remind your listeners to Plato's lambda that he has in the Republic, where he goes 1, 2, 4, 8, and then 1, 3, 9, 27. And what you find is that each number is a geometric mean between its two adjacent numbers. So, for example, 2 becomes a geometric mean. It's the square root of the product of 1 times 4. 1 times 4 is 4, square root is 2. So you see that with the 1, 2, 4, 8, you have geometric means, and then the 1, 3, 9, 27, same thing. In the Timaeus, I guess the key is you really have to look at Plato fairly broadly and link together the hints that he gives in various places. In the Timaeus, he says something very telling. He says there is a bond of nature, and that bond that links everything together, once you translate actually what he says, becomes the geometric mean. There's an arithmetic mean, a harmonic mean, but it's the geometric mean that's the key. So he makes a distinction between what's called discontinuous proportion and continuous proportion. I mean, if you want me to go down this path, it gets a little detailed, but we can do it.
Sure. Why don't you give a little bit of a description about it? You know, you don't have to go too far, but okay. Let's see if you can, you know, give us a solid synopsis, if that's possible.
Okay. Well, let's say that you have a geometric proportion that is discontinuous, where there are four different terms. Now, instead of using the smaller going to the larger, let's do the larger to the smaller. So let's say you have 8 is to 4 is as 2 is to 1. Those are both doubling. Both of them are equal. You have proportion. Now, if you can simplify it, and let's say instead of that particular proportion, you have something similar. You have 8 is to 4 is 4 is as 4 is to 2. You now have a total of three different terms. The 4 is repeated, of course, but that 4 then becomes the geometric mean between the 8 and the 2. 2 times 8 is 16, square root of 16 is 4. That becomes crucial. That's the bond of nature, is you get these geometric means, a middle factor that bonds things together. For example, with the Hermetic maxim, as above, so below, and as below, so above, you must insert, you must figure out how to bond them. Okay, so we go even a step further than that. The question is, can you take a line and cut it unevenly in such a way that the whole line is to one of the segments, the larger of the two, in the same ratio as the larger is to the shorter? Only way to do that is in a golden cut, what the Egyptians called the primordial scission. Those of us who believe or have had experiences that perhaps the universe from the get-go begins as a unity and then fractalizes, that first fracture, that first scission is the golden scission, golden cut, therefore golden section. Furthermore, if you take the two segments, the two pieces that you've cut, and you call one of them A and the other B, the whole is now A plus B, and so now you can say A plus B is to A in the same ratio as A is to B. A becomes the geometric mean between what we call the greater, the whole, and the lesser, the smallest smaller of the two cuts, two segments. That middle factor, that geometric mean, becomes so crucial. And as I'd like to point out immediately, that becomes the basis of all the trinities of the world. In fact, the Neoplatonists carried this over and taught the Christians how to get their notion of a trinity going. And it's so ironic because even the name, as I point out in my book, following the gematria, you find that the name of Christos, which is 1480, when you translate the numbers, the letters into numbers, and the name of Iesus, Jesus, is 888, which is also significant in music. And that ratio of the two together is 5:3, and those become Fibonacci approximations to this divine proportion or divine ratio or golden ratio. So Plato has embedded in his divided line the key to the fractalization, in fact, the creation of the universe. And what's so significant is at every single level, John Martineau found this with, for example, the orbits of the planets and their sizes. He found, for example, that Mercury's orbit, when you average it out, take the mean orbit, much like Kepler did, and you take the mean orbit of the Earth, they're in the golden ratio squared. It's like the octave up. Not only that, but the sizes of the planets, if you take the mean diameter of both planets, it's the most bizarre thing you've ever seen. In both cases, they're in golden ratio squared to the second power in relationship. And then there are other logoi, and that's where logos comes in. I know that's one of your questions. I'm going to just deal with it right now. Logos means ratio primarily. Now, yes, it does mean word or verbum, but it means the relationship, that which bonds together, that ties things together. And there's also square root of 2, square root of 3. Those are crucial. But what I've shown, and it's in my little golden section book, is I found a way that you can derive these other roots, these other logoi, root 2 and root 3, from the golden mean. And that's why with Plato, if I can say another word about it, not only does he solve the mystery of how the universe fractalizes from top to bottom, but he also, in the Timaeus, He describes, we got 5 Platonic regular solids that fit perfectly within a sphere. All their faces are equal on them, unlike the Archimedean, the 13 Archimedean solids. Even the numbers of the solids are significant because, as we'll see later when we get into Fibonacci numbers, we'll see 5 and 13, those are Fibonacci numbers. But the crucial point is, for the ancients, Plato included, they took 4 of those Platonic solids, the tetrahedron with 4 equilateral triangles, that was fire. The octahedron, 8 sides, all equilateral triangles, that was air. The icosahedron with 20 equilateral triangles, that was water. And then the cube or the hexahedron, with square faces, that was earth. So you have the 4 elements, earth, air, fire, and water. The equilateral triangles, when you bisect them, they give you the square root of 3. And Plato in the Timaeus says there's 2 very sacred triangles that build up the cosmos. The other is when you take the face of a cube, you bisect it along the diagonal, and you get root 2. Those became the 2 sacred modulars to build the cosmos. But conspicuous by its absence, and there are others, I'm not the first to point this out. Keith Critchlow, for example, who I learned much of my geometry from, he pointed this out earlier, that it's very strange that the dodecahedron is not described, and yet that represents the cosmos. The 12 faces are all pentagons. But here's the catch. If you take a pentagon and you start drawing lines, diagonals, you form a pentagram, you immediately have the golden ratio. because the same thing that happens with cutting the line in a golden cut is everywhere in the pentagram. This was the big forbidden thing, was to reveal the nature of the golden section. To reveal it, that was the penalty was death. And so what Plato does in the Timaeus...
Is that why Christians have turned the symbol of the pentagram into a symbol of devil worship? Is that so that people don't look at it, so that they're afraid to go there?
Well, it's very possible. I don't know if many have been that sophisticated with that, because when you do invert it, you do like Eliphas Levi and others would put a horned goat with the goat's horns, using those points up like that, and people kind of in the kind of the satanic tradition will invert anything that is considered good. But it's like the number 13, which is a Fibonacci number. It's like the number 666, to go along with what you're saying. 666 is 0.666 is really, it's the division of two Fibonaccis, 2 divided by 3, and it's a musical fifth. It's one of the key, and it's a golden ratio approximation. So there may be a lot in what you're saying. However, for the ancient Pythagoreans, a pentagram was their sacred symbol, and it meant health, because there's all balance, it's equilibrium. So how that really happened, the history of it, I can't really, with any authority, tell you for sure. But there may be an aspect to that, because oftentimes things that are esoteric, that are not to be revealed, are oftentimes hidden behind the masquerading under, oh, this is evil or this is bad. But, you know, as Heraclitus said, the way up and the way down are one and the same. And so when you take a pentagon and put a pentagram inside, you'll notice in the center of that pentagram is another pentagon, and you get an inverted pentagram. They flip back and forth to infinity. And, I mean, ultimately, there's no evil in that. That is nature's way of expressing itself.
Let's talk about proportion.
Well, going back to this notion of ratio leading to proportion. Proportion is repeated ratio. It's as simple as that. And then the thing about the golden ratio, golden section, golden ratio, they're really the same thing, looked at in slightly different ways, but they're essentially the same. And when you get what's called the divine proportion, here's what's magical. All you need is to do the golden cut. The golden section of a line immediately gives you proportion. There's no other way to do it. And it looks like, even if we're wrong, that there is a divinity, some divine, who knows what behind the scenes that's doing this. But anybody who's had any kind of deep, from my perspective, deep mystical experience realizes there's intelligence all the way up and all the way down at all levels, way beyond where we're at, unless one's a Buddha and goes into quantum coherence with it. But that's a later part of our story that's very important. So what my point is, even if that isn't the case, that it is simply nature and nature unfolds and who knows how or why, nature uses economy, uses the simplicity. And this turns out to be the mother fractal. The mother fractal, this is the simplest fractal you can get, and it's perpetuated at all scales. When people have asked me in the past, well, where do you find the golden section, the golden ratio, the divine proportion? My answer again and again has been, where do you not find it? I have not found a single place where you don't find it, at the heart of things. So, the importance about proportion, now proportion and ratio and symmetry, maybe we should clarify this a little bit, because some people are going to say, well, wait a minute, when you get into art and you have people using the golden ratio or golden section, isn't that kind of a static? Isn't it like a cookie cutter? It's an archetype that just is repeated in the same way. No, this is the key. The infinite, almost or seemingly infinite diversity of nature is based upon really three primary ratios. And the mother ratio is the golden ratio. That root 2 and root 3, they're very important too, because nature builds with those. But the fact of the matter is, the golden ratio and therefore divine proportion lies behind them. And I can show you, and I've shown it in the book, and it's, I mean, nobody's questioning it. There's not a single person who's challenged this because they can't, because they know it's the truth. I had a waking dream at Buckfast Abbey when I was doing sacred geometry with Keith Critchlow. And I wasn't asleep. I was in this kind of twilight state, and I jumped up and I realized, oh my God, if you take and make a right angle triangle with the golden ratio of, now there's a greater sense of the golden ratio, the larger, which is 1.6180339, goes on to infinity. And let's just say 1.618 for short. On the other hand, there's a lesser, there's a smaller version of it, which is its reciprocal. It's 1/1.618039, which turns out to be exactly the same number minus 1.6180339. When you take that greater and that lesser and you make a right angle triangle, the hypotenuse turns out to be exactly the square root of 3. Now, that was a rediscovery. I have no doubt, no question in my mind, that that was known to those in the perennial philosophy, ancient wisdom, taught in initiations. But then I was also taught that there's a second way you can get a very divine ratio. And that is when you take what I just called the lesser, 0.618, make that one leg of a right angle triangle, and then you make the other leg the square root of the golden, of the greater, of 1.618. When you do that, you get exactly root 2. So out of the matrix of the golden ratio and its reciprocal and its square root evolves or unfolds root 2 and root 3, the very things that Plato and the Timaeus had said, those are the best, those are the greatest, or the most important. But then remember, and I don't know if I finished this part of the story, he says, if anyone, well, first of all, he says, if there's anything, any principle prior to this, God only knows, and he who is a friend of deity or of God. He then says, if someone can show us a more perfect form, we will give that person the palm as a friend, not as an enemy. So again, what he's doing is he's hinting all along. This is why Plato is absolutely crucial to the rediscovery of what's going on in nature, because he's got it. He's got it embedded in his dialogues. When you add to his dialogues what's called the unwritten tradition, the Agrapha Dogmata, there are hints there where you find out what he's really discussing, and he calls it the one and the indefinite dyad.
And so why don't we go into Aristotle, since we just talked about Plato?
Okay. Well, you know that Aristotle was a student of Plato for 20 years. I tell my students, you know, you think it's rough you have me for a semester or for a period of time. But when Aristotle was missing in the academy, Plato used to say, "Where is the mind?" I mean, he was so brilliant. Now, that doesn't mean he perfectly understood the mathematics of Plato, but nevertheless, he understood this notion of the golden mean. And the further thing that we perhaps need to understand is that when we talk about a mean, or golden mean, or geometric mean, it's the mean between the extremes. And this really does bring up the indefinite dyad, so I probably need to address this. The great mystery in the mystery tradition, so the big question of Plato was always, what the heck is the indefinite dyad? We know from his dialogues that the one is also the good, when you come up out of the cave, the prisoner who's released and methodically goes up out of the cave, sees the light, he sees the good or the one, but then it's the indefinite dyad, the greater and the lesser, which is the other principle that was always the great mystery, both in Plato and in the mystery schools as I understand them. What we've discovered is the greater and lesser, the indefinite dyad, simply turned out to be the golden ratio in its greater sense, 1.618, and in its lesser sense, the reciprocal. 1 over the greater is the lesser, or 0.618, and all the digits to infinity, both of them are identical. And again, if you multiply those two numbers together, the golden ratio and its reciprocal, you get unity. If you subtract them, you get unity. Now, no other number at all accomplishes that. So the indefinite dyad then, the greater and the lesser, you've got the geometric mean now, turns out to be unity. One becomes the mean, geometric mean, between the greater and the lesser. Now, what Aristotle does, brilliantly, he takes his ethics. And what he does is, with his ethics, is he discusses the more and the less. I'll give you a good example. He takes the virtue of courage as the geometric mean between someone who excessively, say in a wartime, jumps out of the trench, runs after the opposition, gets himself or herself killed, and is no good whatsoever to the rest of the troops. On the other hand, the lesser would be represented by one who cowers in the foxhole and is unwilling to make a move. And then the geometric mean, the golden mean, that's why Aristotle called it the golden mean, is courage, where there's a balance. It's kind of like, maybe I can bring this up now, Buddha's middle path. The middle is not in the center. It's a very good reason. The middle path is in the golden cut, so that there's an equilibrium, a balance. This also has a lot to do with the reason the universe has this tremendous power and energy that gets transformed into the spirals. If we go back for a second, if you cut that line in the middle, if your primordial scission is not a golden scission, you have, yes, you have bilateral symmetry, but you don't have any oomph. The oomph, the movement, the holo movement, as David Bohm called it, of the universe, is in the initial cut. And it's like the Big Bang. It fractalizes, it does the whole thing, and then it fractalizes down all the way down to the quarks and subatomic particles. So that's my two cents on Aristotle.
All right, Scott, let me ask you, what was the great key of the mysteries?
Well, it's closely related to what we've been discussing all along here. And that big secret simply had to do with what is the indefinite dyad? And to answer that, it's the golden section. Knowledge of the golden section is, if we're right about this, and it's scale independent, it's at every level, it becomes the key to nature. We'll see it at some point in the DNA, in the way nucleotides arrange themselves. And by the way, maybe now is a good time, I was going to jump into the Fibonacci numbers. Let me just make one comment about, we don't need to discuss them yet, and I'll go back to the thrust of your question. Nature tends to use whole numbers in the way it expresses itself. Some people are very confused about this. There have been other authors, and I have high respect for them, but if they don't get an actual perfect golden cut, they don't think the golden section's at work. It's kind of like logic, where people are locked into the law of excluded middle and law of non-contradiction. You get this baby logic, you get this black and white, either it is or it isn't. And nature's more like fuzzy logic. It's more like three-valued logic. It uses whole numbers to express the golden ratio in practical terms. So when you count the number of, say, spirals going clockwise on a pine cone, and then compare it to the number of spirals on going counterclockwise, you're not going to come up with an irrational number. You're going to come up with typically 5 is to 3, or 8 is to 5, or 13 is to 8. So nature tends to transmit these things into a whole number approximation. But they're still significant. They're still golden ratios. And so as a result, when you really study this stuff carefully and you look at the physics, you look at the chemistry, you look at the genetics, you look at how the nucleotides form, you take a DNA and you sagittally cut it, you find that it's a decagon. Well, what's a decagon? A decagon is two pentagons superimposed. It's all golden ratios. Again, there's not a place that I have not looked that you're not finding this popping up.
What was the great key of the mysteries?
It's the golden ratio.
What is the foundation of all trinities? But you've already covered that, right?
Well, I have, and again, just as a reminder, it's the whole length is to the, when you cut it, you've got a longer segment and a shorter. You know, and actually, let me show you very quickly a way to kind of display this. Well, let's say I have a yardstick, which is 36 inches in length. And by the way, this is why John Michel and others were so adamant that these measures are not happenstance, and there's a reason there's 36 inches. But the point is, and the reason, one of the reasons, of course, is that it relates to a circle, because there's 360 degrees in a circle. So what applies to the yardstick is going to apply to the circle when we golden cut it. So going back to my earlier point about if you cut the yardstick in half, you'll have the ratio of 2 to 1, the entire yardstick of 36 is to 18, 2 to 1, but then you'll have 1 to 1 in terms of the two segments. 2 to 1 is not equal to 1 to 1, so you don't have proportion. But then again, there is a way that if you cut it properly in the golden cut, you'll discover that you have one segment which is going to be 22 and a quarter inches. But I think it's important to recognize, translate that into a decimal, 22.25 inches. The other is going to be 13 and three quarters inches, 13.75 inches. This becomes extremely relevant when we come to phyllotaxis leaf arrangement in plants, which we're not going to jump into yet. But here's your trinity then, is when you have, here's the greater, here's the lesser, and this becomes the geometric mean in between. Here is Brahma, here's Shiva, but here's Vishnu. Vishnu, the middle member of the trinity, which regularly incarnates. Here's the father, the mother, and here's the sun in between. Kether Hakmabina. I mean, there's so many different ways you can look at it, but that is the, and the Pythagoreans did the same thing. So again, and it's a Trinitarian move that links, and again, I'm not trying to talk religion now, I'm simply talking mathematics. I mentioned before the Hermetic maxim, as above, so below, and as below, so above. The link, the bond that goes in between is the geometric mean. And the thing about the golden ratio, by the way, isn't the fact that it's 1.6180339, etc. It's that it's the geometric mean of all geometric means. If this is the bond or glue of nature, and this is the simplest fractal, and this is what initially bonds everything together, it looks like from top to bottom, what's happened with the universe is it's fractalized, making it holographic, so that no matter where you are, if you know thyself, as the Delphic Oracle suggests, you will understand the entire system. So no matter, it's scale independent. It applies at every single scale. I have not found a single place, level, where it is not simply applying again. So back to the Trinity, there's your Trinity.
What is the Fibonacci sequence?
Well, the Fibonacci sequence, interestingly, begins with a zero, and the next number is a one. And so each new number is the sum of the previous two. So 0 plus 1 is 1. 1 plus 1 is 2. 1 plus 2 is 3. 2 plus 3 is 5. So it goes 0, 1, 1, 2, 3, 5, 8, 13, 21, 34, 55, 89, 144, 233, etc. Now, here's the catch. If, just for the moment, ignoring the 0, which I realize there's a great mystery there, but let's just talk about the one. One is one divided by one. As soon as you make ratios, 1 over 1 is 1. 2 over 1 is 2. You now have a range between 1 and 2. And now every new ratio, 3 divided by 2 will be 1.5, a little bit less than the golden ratio of 1.618. You now have 5 is to 3, 1.666, a little bit more. And then you go to 8 is to 5, 1.6, a little bit less than the golden ratio, but getting closer. So what happens is you get this wave moving, all of the ratios to infinity moving, pulled, teleos. That's why it was called the Telesterion, by the way, at the Eleusinian Mysteries. That was the Temple of Initiation. The teleos, it would pull you, and these divine numbers are pulling you all the way, so that any level you stop at, you have, for example, if you take a DNA molecule, and you take a full twist, a full strand, you find that it is 34 angstroms in length by 21 angstroms in width, golden ratio. Head of a sunflower, 34 is to 21, or 55 is to 34. Maybe in a big one you might have 89 is to 55. You find it everywhere, this ratio, this relationship. So the thing about Fibonacci's is that of all the series of numbers you could have, they get you the quickest to the golden ratio. I should point out to your listeners, and many of them are already going to know this, you could take any two numbers to start with, and you could make an additive series, and they will asymptotically, above and below, move into the golden ratio in infinity. There's not a number series you can generate that doesn't do it. So the beauty of Fibonacci, and the reason it's everywhere, is because it's nature's simplest, immediate way to get there. The other thing to recognize is not only is it additive, perfectly additive, but it's approximately geometric or approximately multiplicative. What do I mean by that? That means that each new number is approximately the golden ratio as a modular times the previous one. Now, it's quite distant at the outset, but very quickly it begins to apply. So, for example, golden ratio times 3, if you take your calculator, take a look, and you'll find that you're getting relatively close to 5. Golden ratio times 5, even closer now to the number 8. Golden ratio times 8, and then as you get into the higher numbers, it gets very, very quickly, very, very close. So here's what's happening. The Fibonacci numbers are the quickest way to take the modular and apply it to anything and basically get the next Fibonacci number. Again, it's an approximation, but I challenge any of those people who have been denying golden ratios at work with Fibonacci's or any other number series that we will speak about later, like the Lucas, they are modeling this divine, that's why it's called the divine proportion or divine ratio. It is the way the universe uses to manifest these things. It's a divine modular.
Let's talk about fractals and the mother fractal.
Okay, well, fractal, now there are different ways to understand fractals, and I want to grant that. But there's a geometric way that those who've studied it very closely, when you fractalize, you're fracturing, and the fracture gets repeated at all scales. So you get this iteration process, and you get self-similarity. That may be probably a key factor in fractalization. Now, the reason the golden ratio becomes the mother fractal and has been discussed by several of the scholars, I'm not the first to say this, is that it becomes the simplest fractalization process. So when you look at nature, not just present nature, if you look at fossils, this happens in the spirals. Now, not every spiral is a golden spiral. Some are a little bit more, some are a little bit less. In other words, the divergence angle can change in these spirals. But the mother fractal, that is kind of like the geometric mean between all of the greaters and the lessers, turns out to be your golden mean fractal or your golden mean spiral. I mean, I was shocked when I went into the Museum of Natural History in Washington, D.C., and I started looking around and realized, oh my God, everything is, if you think about it, everything in nature, as it grows, it pushes out and it spins. It rotates and it forms spirals. So when you talk about subatomic particles, you talk about their spins. When you look at the morphology of a plant, we call it phyllotaxis, used to be simply referring to the leaf arrangement, but now we realize that this applies to the cacti. It's not just the leaves, it's the buds, the seeds, it's kind of a universal concept that this phyllotaxis has boiled down to. And if it's fair for me to move into that, or I'll back off and I'll allow you to ask the question.
Let's go into it for a couple of minutes. We still have a lot more ground to cover, though.
Okay, no, that's fine. What's very interesting about, let's just talk about plants and as Brian Goodwin said, there's 250,000 species of higher plants that are well known. Well, if you've been in the rainforest in Peru and Brazil like I have, you realize there's a whole bunch of those that we have no idea. Some of them that even look like they're combinations, plants and insects. I mean, my God, we haven't even scratched the surface of the diversity that's out there. But just talking about the ones we're very, very clear about, there are three types of leaf of phyllotaxis, leaf arrangement, basically, that it can occur. One is called distichous, which is that if you have a circle and it's 180 degrees, like a corn, where the leaves go out on each side, back and forth, 180 degrees. Then there is whorled, which does the same thing, but then goes at 90 degrees at an angle. And so you go like this, and you go back and forth at 90 degrees. And so there's like basically four petals, if you look from the top down, kind of running up. But even at the top of those, there's a tendency for them to spiral. You'll see them rotate at the very top. I'm getting them there. The third way is a spiral phyllotaxis. Spiral phyllotaxis yields the type of leaf arrangement or buds, whatever it might be, that allows for maximum moisture to come to them, maximum sunlight. They don't cover the other either leaves or buds, and maximum exposure to pollination. And furthermore, they spiral the water down to the roots. And guess what? Four out of five of all plants use spiral phyllotaxis, in which the golden ratio, and I'll have to explain this a little more in a moment, is the primary way that it's done. It's the primary, it's called divergence angle. Now, here's what's very interesting about it. We go back to that using the yardstick and golden cutting it. You remember those two numbers we have. There's 22.25 inches and there's 13.75 inches. Well, if you got a circle of 360 degrees, all we're going to do then is, just like the 36 inches, we multiply times 10. You do the same thing with 220, you get 222 and a half degrees, and you get 137 and a half degrees. 360 to 222 and a half is as 222 and a half is to 137 and a half, and it's the shorter one, the little baby one, that if you look at the divergence angle on the plants, that's the one that comes up in the majority of plants. 137 and a half degrees is the winding angle of plants of a hurricane. In physics, there's not a place where that is not the primary thing. In other words, the golden ratio is coming in and is rotating and forming all of this infinitely diverse nature, and yet it comes back to my answer to those who think that this is just like you're using a modular. If a painter is going to apply this in their art, it's as if it becomes static. No, to the contrary. This allows for the dynamism, the dynamics of nature itself is rooted back in the logos. In the beginning was the logos, the ratio, the golden ratio that is ruling everything throughout nature.
Atoms and quark masses and chaos border.
Well, this is where Muhammad El-Nashi comes in. And what Muhammad El-Nashi, who's twice been nominated for the Nobel Prize, has done, and it's been somewhat surreptitious, and he admits this, that when he discovered the golden section or golden mean, he began applying it to solve various mysteries in physics. In fact, he's probably the most prolific writer in physics, and his use of the golden ratio in all of these, solving the double slit experiment, the wave particle duality, again, this golden mean bonds together all of the conundrums that normally we can't solve, and he's done it. In fact, he's taken the golden mean, well, let me back up for a second, the golden mean as the lesser 0.618 is how physicists like to use it. I usually find that artists tend to prefer using the greater version, the 1.618, relative to 1. He carries it to the third power, calls it the subtle mean. Okay, let's go to the chaos border. What they find is there's a chaos limit. When you go from order to chaos or vice versa, it goes through a window. That window is guided by the golden ratio. Secondly, to get what they call, a Hamiltonian, to get solidity, to get a structure, you need irrational numbers. It's really strange. I've had people who come to me and say, well, I can't believe that this is the most irrational number. How can something be more irrational? The golden ratio turns out to be the most irrational of all irrationals. As a result, it's what gives you phase locking. It allows stability. Then furthermore, so not only is it at the chaos border, it gives you structure and stability, it solves the double slit experiment and also the wave particle duality. But furthermore, the quark masses El-Nashi has discovered, and you'll see this in my golden appendix number 5, I've got his quark, the measured masses, but then also his theoretical masses coming from the golden ratios. It's the most bizarre thing. They all turn out to be functions of the golden ratio. Then the fine structure constant. I mean, I could go on and on with this. It turns out to be based upon the golden ratio. So when you build up out of the quarks, you build up your electrons, your protons, your neutrons, they turn out to be functions ultimately of the golden ratio. All of physics builds up like that.
Where does string theory come from?
Well, with your string theory, And again, there are a lot of conundrums and puzzles and problems, but in my discussions with Elnashi regarding strings and string theory, you know, there are a variety of theories at the heart of physics, but he sees them as a kind of family. The thing about the strings is we're looking at nature now as being more like, well, you've got the particles and you've got the waves. And so your waves are more like a set of harmonics, and they're little vibrating strings that when they manifest as particles, so you've got waves being converted over into particles and vice versa, going through this window with the golden ratio. And so, as Elnashi said, if you look at it closely, you'll find that the standard theory of physics with their elementary particles and their corresponding strings turns out to be, it looks like a harmonic musical ladder. This actually gets a bit into your quadrivium, in which the structures then are linked to the harmonics, what we would today call music. The whole thing is harmonics. And everything ultimately, if I can go one step further with this, is all resonance. And the same thing, if we move from physics into consciousness, you're going to find the same thing going on. But you may not be ready for that. You're the interviewer, so I'll stop interviewing myself.
All right. How is the Fibonacci code behind superstrings?
That's really probably more for someone like Elnashi to actually explain. He did a paper on Fibonacci numbers and what are called branes, B-R-A-N-E-S. He shows how this is the factor that is in that there's a subtle mean. And the subtle mean is the golden ratio in its lesser form taken to its third power. That subtle mean they find throughout, and but then it gets expressed. Probably, I guess the best intuitive way I could try to express it without having Elnashi here is that Fibonacci numbers expressed as integers are like particles. And the golden ratio in and of itself is more wave-like. So as they express through the Fibonacci numbers, you're moving from the strings into the particle expressions of them.
Are you familiar with David Harriman's lecture, The Philosophic Corruption of Physics?
Actually, I'm not.
It's a very good lecture. He takes a pretty head-on challenge against quantum physics and string theory, M theory. It shows how it's all tied back to Kant and Hume and these guys.
Well, if I could respond, even though I haven't read it, what I would suggest to
you... It's actually a lecture, but yeah, go ahead.
Well, the big problem, and one of the big problems in physics is finding reconciliation, now of not just waves and particles, but of quantum mechanics and relativity theory. And guess how Muhammad Elnashi has solved that conundrum?
How's that?
Through the golden ratio.
Really?
He is I'm very, very serious about this. And there's good reason. He was Ilya Prigozhin's protege. And as I said, twice he's been nominated for the Nobel Prize. There's been a concerted effort to discredit him because, and I better not get into the suits that are going on right now, but, you know, this is big stuff. Everybody wants to become the new Einstein. If someone can solve that, and he really actually has, if anybody takes a careful look, they want the credit for it. There's huge money in it. And I guess I can go this far and say that Nature and Scientific American have gone on record and published things with people who have actually worked with Elnashi, who are now getting credit, and they're not citing to his work. And it's the most dastardly thing. It's a bigger scandal than the Leibniz-Newton issue about who really came up with the calculus. This is going to be a big one. Mark my words. And one day, Elnashi will win the Nobel Prize in physics if he gets his right too.
Did you want to go more into plants and phylotaxis?
Those who take a look at my little golden section book, you might take a look. There's a page, if I can locate it for you real quickly, in which It's very interesting that this 137 and a half degrees gives this incredibly balanced.
Is that page 15?
Well, 15 is good to see the phyllotaxis and the three different types. But if you turn to the previous page, page 12 on the bottom, you'll see in the middle is the 137 and a half degrees. And on the left and the right is a little bit less and a little bit more. So notice how the emphasis on the rotation shifts from one to the other. But in the middle, you get this perfect balance. Now, not everything is doing the 137 and a half degrees. You get a real variance on this. I could hold up my book, but I really need another edition of it because mine is marked up so much. If you go to the very last page called Phyllotaxis Angles, and you will find different plants and how they're using Fibonacci approximations to this 137 and a half degrees. So again, there is a variance, but all of nature is doing this a little bit more, a little bit less. And it's just so incredible how they're kind of gravitating around that particular modular of what is a perfect golden cut.
The Lucas numbers, what are those?
Oh, now we're getting into the heavy stuff. Oh, my, my, my. Okay, well, the Lucas numbers are a very interesting series named after Edward Lucas, who actually is the one who named the Fibonacci's Fibonacci after Leonardo of Pisa, whose nickname was Fibonacci, son of the bull. But the Lucas numbers, to me, are actually more fascinating. And the reason they're more fascinating is that not because they're less common, certainly, although I think they're less common because I would call them more pristine. Before we discuss Lucas numbers, we need to talk for a moment about what's called the Golden Series. The Golden Series begins with little baby, what I call Phi. Somebody has had to name these the lesser and the greater because everybody gets confused. So for me...
Right. Phi is the lesser and Phi is the greater, right?
Yeah, so like Phi, Phi, Fo, Fum. But the catch is... you got to put insert one between the Phi and the Phi. You know, our fairy tales and our little mythological stories oftentimes contain great secrets, and that may be one of them, quite honestly. But so you begin with little Phi, 0.618. Now, the modular Phi is at work here now. So every time you multiply the modular phi, 1.618 times a number, you get the next one. So phi times little baby phi gives you unity or one. Phi times one, of course, gives you phi, 1.618. Now remember, they're additive as well. So this 1.618 is the sum of the previous two, one plus little baby phi, 0.618. You add them together. Well, now, phi times phi, or phi squared, turns out to be 2.618, is phi plus 1. So as you're moving along, you find that the phi times the previous number gets you the next in the series, and it's exactly geometric. Now, what happens with the Lucas numbers, and the first time I noticed this, because it wasn't really through... so much studying the mathematics, but kind of an observation and playing with the numbers myself, I realized that the Lucas numbers themselves seem to map on very closely. They seem to be approximately phi squared, phi cubed, phi to the fourth, phi to the fifth. In other words, golden section to the first power, second power, third. That's the golden series, beginning with little phi, one, and then phi, phi squared, phi cubed, phi to the fourth, etc. Well, the next thing I noticed was, oh my God, when you take the reciprocal and start squaring, cubing, fourth power, fifth power, you get smaller numbers, just like you take one half and you square it, you get one fourth, and it keeps keeps fractalizing smaller and smaller, just as the other grows, kind of like Alice in Wonderland. You take the pill and you grow, or you take the other one and you diminish. And so you have this diminishing and growing that are balanced. And then the most bizarre thing, and it's in what's called the Binet formula. So there is a formula that is one of the most magnificent pieces of mathematics that's out there in the public domain, but very few people pay any attention. They really do not understand what the heck is going on. So if I can just hold this up, this is page 17 in my little book, Golden Section. If you look over on the left, you'll see the numbers. Let me just make a reference to this right here. On the right, you'll see what we attempted to do by zipping together the golden ratio to the fourth, the greater to the fourth power and the lesser to the fourth power. Let me give you some examples here. So if you take in the Lucas numbers, which begin with 2 and then 1 is the next number, and I know that sounds bizarre, then the next number is the sum of those previous two, so you get 3. 1 plus 3 is 4. So it goes 2, 1, 3, 4, 7, 11, 18, 29, 47, 76, 123, 199. Now here is what is so bizarre about this. The first number in the series, number 2, is the only one that's a little tiny off the pattern, but it turns out to be the greater or phi, which is 1.618, plus the lesser little baby phi squared. So phi plus the greater plus the lesser squared. Let's use greater and lesser. That might be a simpler way to do it. Which turns out to be you got 1.618, etc., plus 0.3819. If you look at the decimals, everything adds to 999999, but you go to infinity, it gives you exactly the number 2. Then the next number 1 becomes a subtraction. Greater minus lesser, 1.618 minus 0.618, and I'm rounding off. The next number becomes an addition. Now, if you want to kind of understand the pattern, the odd numbers now are going to be, from this point on, are going to be, well, no, that's not true. We'll drop that for a second. So number 3 becomes greater squared plus lesser squared exactly. 2.618 plus 0.3819, it'll ultimately give you exactly the number 3. Number 4 is greater to the third power minus the lesser to the third power, so that you're, now this is where I first noticed it. I noticed that the greater to the third power is 4.2360679, etc. And then I noticed that the lesser to the third power is 0.2360697, exact same digits, and they carry on to infinity. They're identical. So you slice off, you subtract off the lesser cubed from the greater cubed, it gives you exactly the whole number 4. 7, and here comes your, well, you got 3, 4, and you got 7, and you've got your quadrivium, and you've got your trivium. And most theosophists say this, most religions, number 7 is very crucial. And that's what I try to zip together over on the one side of the picture here. Let's do that. Over in the far right there, we tried to get, I wanted to, John to get zipper teeth in there, but it was a little difficult. But what you're finding is the greater to the fourth plus the lesser to the fourth, they zip together and give you the integer 7. 11 is going to be the difference between greater to the fifth and the lesser to the fifth. You're going to subtract them. 18, the next Lucas is going to be greater to the sixth plus the lesser to the sixth. It's probably the best image I can give you is like people think here's an integer standing before you with a trench coat on. and suddenly the trench coat opens up, and you see a caduceus, and the central rod is your number, let's say 7, but then you see the two serpents, and the serpents are joining together, and they're the greater to the fourth power and the lesser to the fourth power, and then they pull apart, and they give you the previous number or the next number. They come together, and so it's like the caduceus is my best symbol for it, that the integers, which we think are so special, they really are functions of the irrational numbers, the golden mean and its reciprocal joining together and pulling apart. So here's the deal. Now, let's recall that the Fibonacci numbers are the quickest way to get ratio approximations into nature. And what we find is that, for example, in some pine trees and sunflowers, you might find as much as 10% being Lucas approximations to the golden ratio. So the Fibonaccis are more predominant. The reason I'm thinking that the Lucas are more pristine, more divine, is perhaps a couple things. They track, as I was trying to point out, very closely the golden series itself. So when you see the numbers that crank out, when you square, cube, take to the fourth, fifth, sixth, seventh power of the golden ratio itself, whether you do the greater or the lesser, you find that they're approximating the Lucas numbers Lucas numbers are approximating them very closely. So they're like numbers that are closer, if I'm correct, if we for the moment talk about Plato's divided line, the cave, and he divides his world. When you cut that line for Plato, there's an upper intelligible world, and then there's a lower sensible world. Again, if you want to say symbolically, however you want to look at it, but more in reality. And then he has you golden cut. He says, cut those two segments in the same ratio. So you fractalize it further. And so what do you have up in the top, highest level, are the forms. Then there's a very significant untold level that he hints at, the mathematicals. Then you come down into the sensible world, the corporeal world that we experience here, and you have everyday objects. And then there's a lower level that, if we don't understand what's going on, they become the shadows on the wall that the prisoner in the cave is seeing. But if you come
the allegory of the cave.
If you come up, out, become enlightened, discover the one in the indefinite dyad, you then step down through the forms, which he said are numbers, but the key is their ratios. You step into the mathematicals, they're like the forms, they're perfect, they're the same thing, except they're many, and then you move into the everyday world that we live in, down in the cave, which the fire is shining behind. And then you come into the world where we create our artifacts, our architecture, our music, our sculptures, and we mimic what is discoverable at the top side. Okay, now what a lot of people don't realize is that fractalization leads to the two middle levels, where I call the mathematicals and the everyday objects. The number for those has to be the same. And what it actually turns out to be is the world of forms is big phi, the mathematicals are unity or one, the sensibles down below that are one as well, and then the artifacts become little baby phi. So notice the proportion you have. You have phi is to one, is one is to phi. But what really happens then is one is acting as the geometric mean between the greater and the lesser. So you slide them together and you really have the overlap of the mathematicals that are infused into this world, which give the structure to the pine cones, the shells, the canons of human proportion. All of nature is resonating to these numbers. Okay, now let's go back to our real question here then. The big question is what lies behind the forms. Plato actually says, and Aristotle quotes him in Physics or Metaphysics, he says, Plato says, the one in the indefinite dyad are the principles, even the principles of the forms, as well as the sensible things in our world. That means behind the beauty of the forms themselves is the one and the greater and the lesser. That trinity is what structures everything beneath and everything like a matrix, kind of a geometrodynamic matrix is coming out of that. Okay, so why are the Lucas so significant? Two reasons. The Lucas are very close then to the golden ratio, the greater and its reciprocal, the lesser, and their powers. So the Lucas, not only like Fibonacci, give the ratios in this world, however, they're like, they seldom occur because they're so perfect. They're so close to the golden series itself. And then secondly, as we've already discussed, they combine and pull apart, the greater and lesser, the indefinite dyad itself and their powers, they come together and they pull apart and they come together and pull apart and produce 2, 1, 3, 4, 7, 11, 18. So they are, if someone were to redo mathematics, every single integer can be reconstructed using the golden ratio and its reciprocal, but the simplest are going to be the Lucas numbers. And that brings us into the Tetractus that the Pythagoreans swore by. 1, 2, 3, 4. By the way, at the Timaeus, again, I'm going to try to throw in as much relevant material here as I can. The secret is given at the beginning of the Timaeus when Plato says, 1, 2, 3, but where is the fourth, my dear Timaeus, of our friends who were here yesterday? And what's happened is the fourth person has become sick. What we find from Speusippus, besides the two triangles that I already described earlier, root 2 and root 3, is they consider the equilateral triangle unbisected, uncut, representing unity. That's the one. The 2 is the root 2 triangle. Are we okay? And the root 3 becomes the third triangle, the missing triangle that becomes the source that allows the construction of everything else is the one that nobody could speak about. And that is the triangle that's going to help you build a pentagon. And the triangle that builds the pentagon reveals the secret, really, of the golden ratio or the golden section. So Plato has, in several different ways, through his puzzles and his questioning, revealed that there's a secret that a person who properly studies his dialogues should be able to retroduct or abduct or creatively hypothesize or figure out. And essentially, my study of the golden section in Plato for roughly 40 years now, in 2002, I was able to basically, figure out completely the secret. I really did it in my dissertation earlier in 1983, but if any of you want to take a look at probably my best work, even though most people look to my golden section book, if you Google my name and put in indefinite dyad, you'll automatically go to a paper that was published in the Nexus Journal of Mathematics about the Plato's second principle, the indefinite dyad, where I do both the golden sectioning of the divided line, but also show how the golden ratio allows you to derive subsequently the other logoi, the other roots, the root 2 and the root 3, and so forth. So I hope that I was able to answer why Lucas, to me, is more perfect, more pristine, closer to the golden ratios, but also they build up the integers. And then Fibonacci's are a little bit more complicated. You can look on the same page, and if I can just tell people where to look, and that's on page 17. If you look on the same page at the bottom, you'll see there how the greater and lesser combine in different ways to give you the Fibonacci's. What that really means is every single number that we have is really a function of the golden ratios coming together or pulling apart in different ways. It's the combinatorial mathematics of nature.
Let's talk about Phi in the human body and in plants and animals.
With the human body, there are various canons of proportion. The ancient Egyptians, the Greeks, there's the Romans. There's a mystery with what it was called the canon of Polyclitus. And we have his Doryphorus, or at least, I'm sorry, we have a Roman copy of his beautiful bronze statue, which we no longer have, of the spear bearer, one of the most beautiful statues, even in its form of a copy. And when people look very carefully, they realize we basically have the golden section at work at the navel. But not only that in the sculpting, but when you start examining the body itself, you quickly discover that that's how nature has worked. So here is a golden calipers. No matter how wide or how narrow, the relationship between the two openings is always in a golden ratio. And you can make these very simply. You can use Fibonacci approximations. In fact, the body tends, as I'm going to try to explain, tends to really be more of a Fibonacci approximation usually than exact golden ratios. So it's a very simple thing. If you take a finger and you've got your phalanges, you have a distal phalange at the tip of your finger. I'm using my forefinger as an example here. You have the medial phalange in the middle, and then you have the proximal phalange, the larger part of the finger that is closest to you. If you take the golden calipers and you measure, now it's the bone, it's not the flesh, so it can look, for anybody observing this, and of course I've got a kind of a rough one here, but let's see if we can do it. You measure the tip. You flip it over now with the longer segment. It should take you to the medial phalange. You do the same thing, and you do the, now this is easier, and you can see it better because this is more evident. With the medial phalange, you put the tips where they should have been. They've been knocked off. Flip it over, and you'll come to the next phalange. And you notice that it's the sum of the previous two. So just like Fibonacci numbers are additive, they're also multiplicative. And you could keep going. The whole body becomes a resonance of golden ratios. So when we study, my good friend Lance Harding, someday you may want to have him on your show. He is the world's expert, living expert, I believe, on canons of human proportion. And we lecture together when we do workshops. He's been studying the various canons, whether it's the canons of the Greeks or of the Egyptians. The Egyptians would use these little squares, and you can kind of figure it out. And you'd see, for example, 18 is to 11 with the ancient Egyptians would be one of their canons. There actually were a couple that Lance has worked on. Another one where you find 8 is to 5, or you find 5 is to 3. Now, what I've done over time is I've measured just very simply the a human body. I've had my students simply take their shoes off. I get their height. It's very simple. And I find where their navel is. We mark those lengths. So what we find is the whole body is basically cut at the golden cut at the navel. And you think of the significance of the navel. And I found that most people, it's as if they're 5 units tall, 3 from the floor to the navel, 2 from the navel to the top of the head. What does that mean? That means you get the ratio 5 is to 3 is going to be 1.666, 3 is to 2, 1.5. A little bit more and a little bit less, but you've got it. When I lectured recently up at Wheaton, Illinois at the Theosophical Headquarters, did a workshop on this, I didn't have time to measure everybody, so I picked 2 people randomly. The male came out to be 5 is to 3, 3 is to 2, just like I described. Very, very close. But the female, very interestingly, turned out to be a Lucas approximation. And I've been discovering this over years now, that it's not always Fibonacci. Occasionally you'll find a Lucas. She was as if she's 7 units tall, whatever the units don't have to have any. It's all ratio. And from the floor to the navel was 4. From the navel to the top of the head was 3. So 7:4 is 4:3, a Lucas series, and they're golden section approximations again, which may again have relevance for your liberal arts and your trivium and quadrivium and their relationships as well. Let me do one more on plants. Very interestingly, we find that these harmonics will jump. It's almost like jumping an octave. So, and I think John Martineau mentioned this on your show, because we talked when we were doing my book and I was working there in Glastonbury with him, and he went up to the tour and was doing a walk around, and he came up to a pussy willow, and we'd already discovered that in 5 rotations of the pussy willow, again, things are growing, they push out, and they spin at the same time. So 5 rotations, someone who's been listening to this would say, well, okay, if its Fibonacci ratios approximate the golden ratio, there must be either 3 buds go down one level, or the other adjacent number would be 8. 8:5 or 5:3. Well, it wasn't. It's what we had been studying. It's 13. And 13:5 is the golden section squared approximation. You move up to the next Fibonacci number. In a moment, we'll talk about consciousness and microtubules, and we'll find that double microtubules, whereas regular microtubules have 13 tubulin dimers spiraling, 8 going one way, 5 the other, you go to a double microtubule, and you get 21. It doesn't double 13 to 26. You go to the next Fibonacci number. Now, I've kind of jumped ahead, but let's make sure that we've talked about the plants in several different ways, and the harmonics will skip an octave. So you it's like the shells of a atom, in which the electrons will jump to the next shell, and it's so you're going into these lock modes into a next harmonic. Okay, with animals are the same thing. The animal kingdom is so incredible. For your listeners, there's a beautiful book that does a nice job with animals. We've got some in my golden section book. It's Giorgio Doxy's The Power of Limits. He does a lot of nice images with animals. Also, Darcy Wentworth Thompson's On Growth and Form, a very old book, does really beautiful work with animals. But here again, what you're going to do is you're going to find that the relationships, they can get, again, it's not like a cookie cutter that does the same old thing over and over again. Let me pull out a image from my book with the animals. You'll see that there are a variety of ways that the golden ratio can express itself with the animals. In fact, a number of ways. Now, some of them are going to be pretty darn obvious, where you're just getting pentagonal structures, but it's much more sophisticated. All of nature is resonating that way. Now, here, maybe going back to the human body, Zeising did the same thing. And if you look at his work closely, right over here, you'll find that he's got an image which, in fact, we've got the little letter phi. There's a Fibonacci approximation where the navel cuts us. You know, when they reconstruct, by the way, the human face, if there's been damage to the face and someone has to reconstruct it, or someone's been abducted and they have to reconstruct what the person looked like, they use a golden rectangle, just like you find right on the cover of my book. The golden rectangle here is used to structure the face, because all of the different features of the face are interlinked using those ratios. I mean, I could go on with the animals. And
why don't we touch on art and ceramics real quickly here?
Well, one of the places that you're going to find this, let's just talk for a moment about maybe ancient art for a second. It's quite clear that the ancient Greeks were well aware of the divine proportion. Plato, for example, used to say that Daedalus, when he would do his sculptures, they would look like they were ready to walk right off the dais. It appears that life, and I'm going to add the word consciousness, are resonating to the divine proportion. The fine packing of space, the closest packing of space, is more when you get into things that are hexagonal. Anything that's hexagonal is going to involve two equilateral triangles, and you get root 3 involved there. For example, it looks like in the Renaissance, after Luca Pacioli, the monk drunk on beauty, wrote his book Divina Proportione, it was illustrated by Leonardo da Vinci. What they did is they brought all the golden ratio business from the ancient Greeks and Egyptians into the forefront of the consciousness, not of just da Vinci, but the people in Florence and those who started the whole Renaissance. And so it became a rebirth, not only of Marsilio Ficino and the translation, Medicum and Plotinus and so forth, but it was the ratios and proportions of the ancients that was brought forward. There's evidence that they had these very sophisticated compasses that would have three prongs, not two, and they would open up in such a way that you could take it and you'd take a block of marble, and so the Michelangelos of the world would mark their marble where the navel is, but then they would fractalize it as well, and so you'd find these very, now this is very small, I don't know if we're going to be able to see it, but right where my finger is, you'll see really what's called a golden calipers or compass. You see the three prongs
right
just before the front wheel of the bicycle. Apparently, that's what they would do. Furthermore, the artists then later on they figure out Seurat and the rest of them. People like Da Vinci, of course, he would take and he would fractalize his paintings. Now, this is a root 5 rectangle, which has. If you take a square right here and he would take the horizon and make it at the golden cut, you see here two golden rectangles, which themselves, you take the squares off, you get a smaller golden rectangle. So he would put the horizon there, he'd fractalize it. People like Salvador Dali, what a genius. And I've seen his work both in Florence and elsewhere, and I've read his work. And what Dali would do is, for example, he takes the sacrament of the Last Supper, he takes Christ and he takes in a light body, and then he has the dodecahedron behind him, which is the key, of course, to the golden ratio. And then he takes his canvas and makes it 5 by 3. And so he takes Fibonacci numbers, and so which approximate the gold. Approximates your golden rectangle. So anytime you do that with a canvas, it automatically locks in your viewer into the ratios and proportions of nature. Now, a very key figure that people want to know about is Jay Hambidge and his work with design principles. In fact, we have a chapter on him, but at the end of the book, let me see if I can hold this up, you'll see all these different design rectangles that are using root 2, root 3, golden mean. Anytime he talks about whirling squares, he's talking about golden rectangles. And then in terms of the pottery, that was a question that you had, here's some of his design work when he's analyzing various, this is on pages 32 and 33. So on the bottom of 32, I'll put this up here. You see these drinking cups, and then you see the various vases or pottery that he did. Now, as John Martineau and I would discuss, and we actually wrote it into the book here, you know, sometimes it became quite difficult for people to actually apply these in their pottery. So it's one thing to have the principles, the design principles, and begin to understand them. It's another thing to put them into application. Some of my most recent work, by the way, and this is why I was up there with the Theosophical Society, the Theosophical Society was originally formed after a lecture in, what was it, 1877 by George Henry Felt, in which he was describing a discovery he had made in what he called the Egyptian Kabbalah and the Greek Canon of Proportion. And I've looked at some of the drawings. It's been very difficult to get a hold of any of the work because they lost most of his work in a fire in Boston, and it never really got published. But through Sherlock Holmes-type work with a group working with right now, we've been able to discover and locate some of the drawings that were done, and they are incredible. And they take the different roots, the root 3, the root 2, root 5, golden mean, and they nest them together, and he then uses it in his analysis of various works of art. And what happened at the end of the lecture is Colonel Henry Alcott turned to Madame Helena Petrovna Blavatsky and said, "We need to start a group, a society, to investigate this esoteric knowledge of the ancient Egyptians, Greeks," but it was more universal. And this is where the perennial philosophy comes in and so forth.
All right, Scott, why don't we go into the golden ratio and music, or melody and harmony?
That's probably, to be honest, more of an area of someone like John Martineau, who's really got the expertise in that area.
All right. Well, you know what? And I've got Jason coming on next week anyway, so we'll have him go into
that. Might be better. One initial point that I would like to make is that in terms of the keys and the keyboard, you find some incredible things with Fibonacci numbers involved. Another place that I would like to mention, and we'll kind of leave it at that, is there's a section in the book in the very last page, Appendix 6, called More Lucas Magic. And in that, there's a linking together of, it's the most bizarre thing that I'm aware of. And both John and I are just absolutely fascinated by it, in which the structure of the musical scale gets expressed through the eclipse year, solar year, it's the most bizarre thing, but I don't think anybody fully is understanding it. But I had a fellow by the name of Benjamin Brighton who made deep inroads into it, and John Martineau, who himself is absolutely brilliant. It bowled him over. And there are a couple people that worked on this. One is Robin Heath, as well as Benjamin Brighton and John.
Yeah, and in your book, you do have a little section on melody and harmony on pages 38 and 39, where you also cover the construction or the layout of a violin as well as the piano keys.
Well, for those who are interested, let me show this. There are definitely ways in which it's been discovered that there have been musicians who have purposefully used Fibonacci numbers, like Dufay, and we've got quite a list here: Bach, Bartok, Sibelius, Sabineyev, Beethoven, Haydn, Chopin, Mozart, Schubert, Scriabin. And then with the piano scale, you find that you've got the 8 white notes with the 5 black notes divided into 3 black notes, and then you got the keys on the piano board. And of course, then the Fibonacci numbers appear in the modern scale in pure harmonic intervals, such as the octave. So you got 2:1, you've got the musical fifth, 3:2, the major and minor sixths, so you got 5:3 and 8:5. But it's much, much more than that. And one thing I really want to get across here is the future King of England has recently honored John Martineau by talking about some of his discoveries, but he's taken images right from the book here and lifted them right out. But I guess that's okay. Maybe someday I can become the advisor to him, but he's put them in his book.
All right. What about, and this will be an interesting topic for a lot of people, what about the initiations at Ulysses?
One of the things that I've been very interested in, first of all, is returning to Ulysses and the Telestarion, where hundreds, if not thousands. They say at one time it may have been 3,000, as many as 4,000 people who would go through a major epiphany experience. Proper preparation, as all your listeners know, it's all set and setting, and preparation and the fasting. But when I've gone back, I've looked very carefully at what artifacts are there, at what plants are still prevalent there. I've been able to photograph some of the images, like there are pentagrams and hexagons and various plants that are still growing there, but also etched into the stone. So there are lots of issues there. But apparently, this is one of the great mystery schools. There was one at Samothrake that I visited, and this is where the Theosophical Society comes into play. Madame Blavatsky, who was a student of the ancient wisdom or perennial philosophy, and by the way, Theosophia, divine wisdom, is basically what that means, and their motto is, there is no religion higher than truth. I'm trying to get them to accept that there is no religion or science higher than truth, that even though truth is hard to define, the search for truth, the quest for truth, is what we're really after, not dogmatism of any kind. But anyway, her point was that in these mystery schools, one of the things that was revealed is the sacred ratios and proportions, the numbers and the patterns of nature. And therefore, as a result, the architects, the artists, the sculptors were able to take this information and then they would beautify the world around them. So you get the Acropolis with the Parthenon, the Erechtheum. But you've got to remember that Plato was not only initiated into the Eleusinian mysteries, but also he spent a long time in Egypt. There's a tradition that Pythagoras was there for 20, some say as many as 22 years. Now, that may not be true, but they were being initiated into these ancient mystery traditions. And when you analyze, for example, the Giza Plateau, you find that Badawi discovered over 50 instances in various temples and pyramids and so forth of use of Fibonacci numbers. You find that if you analyze the pyramid very carefully, its structure, you find that the apothem and the casing stones are still there. So you can actually measure the slant. And that is the golden ratio itself, big phi. Its unity, if you take a meridian triangle section and cut it in half, you find that unity goes into the base, and then the height of it turns out to be the square root of the golden ratio. It's all golden ratios everywhere. And by the way, when you form a golden rectangle, one of the things you do is you first form a square, you bisect it, and then you take a diagonal. That diagonal has a very interesting structure. It's 26.5 degrees. If you go into the Great Pyramid, the ascending passageway is 26.5 degrees. The descending passageway is 26.5 degrees. That's how you get a golden rectangle, is first discovering that. Furthermore, Robert Temple on the Giza Plateau discovered, next to the Valley Temple of the Sphinx, there is a passageway that goes nowhere. Nobody has known what that's for. Well, he discovered that it's 26.5 degrees. The other thing that he discovered through looking at old photographs on the summer solstice, there is a shadow that's cast on the back of the Great Pyramid on its south side, a shadow from Khafre's pyramid onto Khufu's pyramid that is 26.5 degrees. It's the most bizarre thing. They were brilliant. Okay, now going to the initiations. It is my findings, my experience, my studies, that, and Blavatsky's claims, that these were what were revealed in the ancient mystery schools. Furthermore, when people have near-death experiences, some of them get into a state where it's like samadhi, and they get all knowledge, have access to any and everything. Some of them, like a guy named Tom Sawyer, it's his actual name, comes back without much of an education at all. He comes back, he knows Planck's equations, sometimes they got Schrodinger's equations. They're getting all these mathematical principles. Another guy comes back and he's got over 100 patents in chemistry now. So what's happening when the time stops and they have these omniscient experiences is they're getting the knowledge of nature's numbers and the mathematics of nature. Same thing happened to me in the jungles in Peru, and I don't mind telling you. And before I actually wrote my book, I went into an experience in isolation, fasting, and working with plant teachers, and the next thing I know, I'm out of my body, and everything that I know about the golden section is shown to me visually. All of nature, the glue of nature, is in fact the golden ratio. That's why it was such a great secret. So these little near-death experiences and our little shamanic experiences, they may not be the real McCoy in the sense of this full-fledged initiatory transformation of consciousness, but they sure give us glimpses as to probably what in fact was going on.
Yeah, and I feel that as far as the entheogenic experience, it seems that the trivium and quadrivium and things like studying these, the golden ratio, as well as the mandalas in alchemy and in Hinduism, Buddhism, are essential to that same type of experience. It seems that studying this stuff causes what seems to me to be the exact same experience as the combined trivium and quadrivium.
If you don't mind, let me lead into that for a moment, because this is really the crux of where it's at. And it has to do with what Roger Penrose and Stuart Hameroff are looking for in what they call the quantum mechanics of consciousness. And what they've been looking at are the microtubules in the brain that now appear to be quantum computers. And what's so fascinating about them is that they're made up of 13 tubulin dimers, 8 spiraling one way, 5 spiraling the other way. They are so central to the structuring, it's kind of the architecture of consciousness as well, and in mitosis, cell division, but even more interestingly, at the synaptic cleft, there are what are called clathrins. Clathrins turn out to be truncated icosahedra. They're buckyballs. If you take an edge of a buckyball, a Buckminster Fullerene, a soccer ball, in England we'd call it a football.
Right, right.
But if you take a look at one, and here they are, and it's on the bottom of page 49 in my book, where I'm discussing resonance and consciousness. So there it is, and that's the sagittal section of DNA next to it. And these are microtubules up on the top up here, and looking down a microtubule. The clathrins, if you take an edge of a clathrin, if that's unity or one, you go across to the other side, it's a multiple of not an approximately, but exactly 3 times the golden ratio, the greater, big phi. And so it's all, what's happening is you're getting into states of consciousness where resonance is happening. One of the great things that David Bohm used to say was the important thing about quantum mechanics and quantum interconnectedness is that the whole universe is in some way enfolded, was his word, enfolded, E-N-folded, into every individual thing, and each thing is enfolded back into the whole universe. Well, what appears to be happening when people get into these higher non-ordinary states of consciousness, they go into quantum coherence. The microtubules and the clathrins go into a lockstep interrelationship, and so that your consciousness now goes into resonance with higher, greater, larger, broader either beings or states of consciousness, all the way up to a Buddha, Siddhartha Gautama, sitting under the Bo tree, going into samadhi and the awareness of the consciousness, perhaps of the entire galaxy, if not the entire universe. So it's all resonance. I guess my point that I'm trying to make is what we're discovering when we go through these experiences, we're like tuning forks. And so we go into attunement, synchrony, resonance, it's all music, with these higher states. Now, this brings us to the quadrivium and the trivium. And it's very interesting that we have the number 7 that is the totality of the two, and they're broken down into 3 and 4. Now, it's very interesting also when you look at what the Pythagoreans swore by, the Tetractus, 1, 2, 3, 4. But, and this is something that John and I did not get into the book, is an esoteric Tetractus, where the first four numbers of the Lucas numbers are 2, 1, 3, 4. You reverse the 1 and 2. Now, the Pythagoreans swore by that, but when you reverse it, something very interesting happens. The ratios between the numbers begin to approximate the golden ratio. So it's not just that you build up the decad out of the 1, 2, 3, 4, but even more deeply or in addition, you get the golden series and their approximations coming out of it. So John and I agreed that in the quadrivium, there's no question the golden ratio is at the core of each one of those subjects. But when you then take the trivium and you relate the 4 and the 3 and the 7, you are now getting golden ratio approximations, and you do an additive series from there on, and you go 11, 18, 29, and there it is, and you're mimicking the golden powers. So there's something, and I don't pretend to claim that I fully understand the answer to the trivium quadrivium question, but I definitely think you're onto something there, and your listeners are onto something that is of the highest, deepest significance. And one other comment that I don't want to forget: on January 7th of 2010. A great empirical discovery was made in England and in Germany. Three labs in England and one in Germany, the Rutherford Lab, Bristol, Oxford Physics Labs, and then the one in Germany, were working together, and they discovered that using Heisenberg's uncertainty principle, they're basically kind of prodding the quantum mechanics theory itself, and what they found at the core of quantum mechanics empirically now, not theoretically, was the golden ratio at the core of quantum mechanics. So again, it's not all theoretical. I mean, El-Nashi stuff is the greatest stuff that I've ever seen, but then to have the empiricists get in there and then find it actually right there at the core is really significant.
What about DNA and genetics?
Well, the DNA, now, I know you're going to be asking me in a moment about my next book, and that's where this comes into the play, but we'll hold off on that. I've got the experts in the world who now have found the golden section at the optimal influence in the heart, in the periodic table of elements, Fibonacci numbers, cryptography, in the quantum computers, and so forth. But the DNA and genetics, really interesting. The DNA itself, as you know, if you do the sagittal section, we already looked at that picture, you get a decagon. A decagon is two pentagons superimposed. Therefore, it's all golden ratios at work. But even furthermore, some of the geniuses, and I've got the best of the best from Russia, Petikov, who has been working with the relationship of golden ratio and Fibonacci numbers to nucleotide formation, when they analyze it very closely, it's all Fibonacci numbers that are at work in this very sophisticated way. It goes way beyond my little golden section book. I must admit that publicly, that they are now seeing this in these matrices that are really quite difficult to understand. It's not a simple thing. The place you want to look, if your listeners are want to go to the standard text that's out there now that I assisted with, it's not my writing, but it's by an absolute genius. His name is Alexei Stakov. It's The Mathematics of Harmony, or Harmony Mathematics, from Euclid's Elements to Modern Day Computers is like a subtitle. It's a little bit of an expensive book. You can get it, but it's available. It's available on Amazon, but it's incredible. And you'll see there Petikov's work, and you'll see other areas of science where it's being applied. But what I'm getting these people to do is do these short summaries for my new book, two-page summaries that we'll implant in the book, where we try to bring it into the public eye, where people can understand it with their diagrams. And I would say he's the expert in the field on this particular subject.
What is the single most important idea that you would like people to take away from this interview?
I would probably say, going back to Plato, the Pythagorean's work, is that, number one, it's the golden ratio that seems to be at the core of our very being and is a modular at work at every level in nature, whether you're looking at the winding number of a hurricane or a tornado, or you're going down all the way to the cellular level with the microtubules, or you're going down to the quarks and so forth. The same ratio or relationship is at work. And probably its most significant area, I think, is in the area of consciousness, in terms of how it relates to our experiences and going into higher and more profound states of consciousness through resonance. It's a fractalization from top to bottom and all the way back up. And the key is entrainment, resonance, synchrony, getting into attunement. And for those of us from a more spiritual perspective, you drop the lower self and you re-identify with the higher self, the Atman. You play the role of a Hindu going after the Atman, which you discover is one with Brahman, but you also play the role of a Buddhist and you go after Anatta. You get rid of all false notions of the self, and there's a re-identification, and I think that's the key.
It sounds like religion and science aren't so far apart after all.
I think there's a geometric or golden mean that will bond.
All right. Oh, let's see. Scott, what is the title of your new book? And do you want to talk about that for a minute?
Oh, sure. I'd be happy to. The title of the new book is Divine Proportion, The Mathematical Perfection of the Universe. And I have some big guns involved. I'll be writing the book, of course, and it's been years of study of both the sciences and the arts and various other things. But my preface will be done by the sacred geometer of all geometers, Keith Critchlow, who's emeritus professor of Vita, Visual and Islamic Traditional Arts, at the Prince of Wales School of Architecture, who also had the Cairo School. The foreword is going to be done by my good friend, in fact, I'm visiting him this next weekend, Houston Smith. And then I've got experts who are going to be working on, as I said, the optimal heart, the Fibonacci involved in the periodic table of elements. El Nashi will contribute his piece on physics. Alexei Stakov will do his piece on the quantum and Fibonacci computers. I've got Lance Harding doing his piece on the canons of proportion. And I'll do the a broad spectrum of various things, decoding the messages of Plato, the mystery of numbers, nature's way of approximation, the natural world of number, the ancient world. We'll look back at the theosophists, but perennial wisdom primarily there, art, architecture, and music. We've got David Feidler with Pythagorean harmonics. John Martineau is going to do his wonderful work with the orbits of the planets and their sizes related to this. I've got Stephen Phillips with the Tree of Life, the Sri Yantra, and the I Ching. We're going to look at the holographic nature of the universe, Philosopher's Stone, Golden Ratio and Healing, Pythagorean Tetractus. We're going to basically cover the gamut, but in color this time, in a coffee table size book, and because I've made friends with the people in Russia and the Ukraine, I've got some really heavy-duty people who have made big inroads, whereas here in the West, for some reason, we seem to be a little step behind with a few exceptions. And then, of course, with some future Nobel laureates on our side as well.
And would you like to give out any website or contact information?
Well, my contact information, quite honestly, I've not put a website together. You can Google my name and you'll get some of the papers easily enough. I'd also suggest that you take a look at some of Al-Nashi's work, but also beware that those who are trying to detract and keep him from gaining credit, they've tried to detract from him. My email address, and I'm happy to put that out there for you for any questions, be happy to respond to you, is my last name, Olsen, O-L-S-E-N, and then the first initial S, so Olsen's at cf.edu, cf.catford. short for education, edu.
Great, Scott, and thank you so much for your time and this wonderful interview. And I hope to have at least the audio up on Monday. It may take me a little while longer, hopefully not too long, to get the video up as well.
Well, Jan, it's been a great pleasure. And as John Martineau said to me not too long ago, he said, this is an interviewer that you want to be on his show. And I really appreciate it. This has been a great pleasure for me.
Well, thanks. And I appreciate the kind words back from John Martineau as well.
Okay. And you've done, by the way, you've done some great work in your writings, and I want people to be aware who have never watched this before, and I'm going to be telling them about your work. You've done a great service.
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate that.